The Guardian.
Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy, it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Book Club. I'm Claire Armistead, books editor of The Guardian and Observer. This month's guest is James Elroy, who's over in the UK to promote his latest novel, Perfidia. We nabbed him to discuss a different book, The Black Dahlia, which was published in 1987 and was the first in his classic LA quartet. Based on an infamous murder which took place a year before Elroy himself was born, it is, as he wrote in The Guardian, a tale of love in conflict with sexual obsession. Book Club host John Mullen started by asking him if he was comfortable with a recent description of him as king of meta-historical, postmodern, hard-boiled noir.
Postmodernism denies scope,
yeah,
probity, morality at all, plot, and seeks to render these things absurd.
Okay.
I am a romantic.
Okay. Can we go with meta-historical romantic hard-boiled noir?
What does meta mean?
I don't know, actually.
Is that like metastasized?
That's kind of, I think, when it's historical, but it's also ironically historical. Actually, the first thing I wanted to ask about, really, was the history thing.
Yes.
Not the meta-historical, not that, but the history thing. Because I guess some people from films, as well as all the people who have read the novels, have a kind of place and a period in their heads because of your novels, really. And, of course, the place, we'll talk about that too, is Los Angeles. And the period, you've gone up to the 60s, I know, but I think we mostly think of the 40s and early 50s. And I suppose the place to start is by asking, why has that period so engrossed you and become the sort of period of that you've created for all our imaginations, really?
I would cite the concept of racial memory, racial in the sense of the human race. There is a spiritus mundi. It exists. There is a collective unconscious. I'm a Christian. I believe that we are all one soul united and that our perceptions are interchangeable between, say, the 450 souls in this room. I felt as a child, born in 1948, that World War II was still going on. I said something in 1956 that alerted my mother to this misconception. She said something along the lines of, au contraire, Sonny, the war ended 3 years before you were born. I didn't believe her then, and I'm not sure I do now, because I live in my imagination. My imagination, even before my mother's celebrated murder in 1958, had honed in and obsessively on the decade before my birth and cognizance, the 1940s. It lived in me, and I still live in it.
That's very important in the novel, isn't it? That it's a kind of post-war novel, that there are people coming back from something that maybe was terrifying, and they're kind of peculiarly, in some cases they seem quite psychotic, but anyway, ill-suited for a world that's not at war.
Yeah, L.A., come on vacation, go home on probation.
And is it also a kind of allow you a certain freedom as well, writing about the 40s or the 50s, that you can create that world without kind of answering to people who are around now who say, well, actually, the LAPD do this or they don't do that. Is there a feeling of sort of freedom when you do?
I get to live it,
yeah,
chiefly. I get to be there and live racial memory and live in a time where I wasn't even born. So I get to be the killer.
Yeah.
I get to be the victim. I get to be all the characters. That's where I want to live. America's recent past is my historical fixation, and it's where I voluntarily live.
Everybody in it, I mean, it's something that you can't help but notice. All the people in it the cops, the criminals, the bit part players, they don't have any hesitation, do they, about voicing all their kind of their bigotry, their hatred, their malice against one group or another. And it feels like it would be very difficult to kind of do that in the same way, to have those characters who sometimes take you aback, the things they're prepared to say to each other quite candidly. To have those characters in a kind of contemporary setting would be harder, wouldn't it?
Let's talk about this for a second. Frank O'Connor said, a literature that cannot be vulgarized is no literature at all and will not last. I like racial invective. I like Yiddish. I like black hepcat hipster jazz patois. I like profanity. I like scandal language. I like spelling hard C words with a K because it looks cool on the page. People today, people who subscribe to the fatuous notion of political correctness, want their racism canonized as a defining characteristic. With my characters, au contraire, it's a casual attribute. None of my heroes has ever been in the Klan, America First, or the Thunderbolt Legion. These are men and women admirable in many regards, less than admirable in their racial attitudes of the time. And to portray racism, or dare I say, homophobia, as just something very casually in their mind and in the language of the time shocks the shit out of people.
The place as well as the time. We're talking about the time, the place. Now, I was thinking, we were talking in the green room before we came in about film adaptations. I was talking about how I saw L.A. Confidential before I read any of your novels. And you see the film, and it's all sunlight and kind of goldenness, mm-hmm. or a lot of it is. I know some of it's at night, but there's a lot of sort of kind of golden California. But you read these novels, and L.A. feels like a very, very dark place indeed. Mm-hmm. Even in the daytime, it feels like a dark, dark place. And it also feels like a place that's sort of being torn down and put together again.
Yeah.
Am I right? I mean, 1940s LA seems to be a place that's kind of changing. And even the Hollywood sign in the Black Dahlia is getting kind of, some of it's getting ripped down.
It's building up, it's building out. Statistically, it is a gnat on one hair on a rabid pit bull's back compared to the recently concluded war 57 days of the Blitz and the bombing of London, 73,000 people in this city killed, plus the maimed. It's nothing compared to the Second World War. However, we're talking of a microcosm. It's the microcosm that the novel is in its final form itself, and it's this localized world of cops, criminals, homosexual informants, bent DAs, and twisted politicians.
I mean, in the bent cops, obviously there's some bad guys in the LAPD, in the Black Dahlia, but also, you know, because it's Guardian Book Club, we're allowed to kind of give away the plot. I hope you realise that's part of the deal, yeah? We're allowed to give, oh no, they don't sound very pleased about it. Well, we are. We don't give away the plot of Perfidia. No, they're going to buy that one.
No.
But they've already been studying the Black Dahlia. And so we're allowed to give away the plot. And one of the, I mean, I guess it's a convention of hardball detective fiction that your detective quite often has a buddy, and sometimes the buddy turns out to be not so good as the detective had hoped. But in the Black Dahlia, the buddy turns out to be biggest crook. I mean, he's a kind of despairing crook in a way.
Yeah.
He's not a happy crook.
No.
But I mean, he's done almost every bad thing in the novel. He's sort of involved in it. And you do a real upending of the conventions of such narratives where we find out not only did he know or have a good idea, but his girlfriend, who becomes Bucky's wife, she knew too.
She did not know. Now, John, you got that wrong.
She did not know. Okay.
And
okay.
I wrote the book, John.
I'm going to get. No. Okay. Can I try a quote?
I'm listening.
Okay. This is verbatim. Okay. Okay, you've pushed me to this. This is page 359 on the paperback. I said, Kay, Lee knew who killed Elizabeth Short. Did you know that? Oh, yeah, you're right. She knew that he knew. Okay. She knew that he knew.
In the words of numerous Hollywood producers, trust me on this.
Yeah, well, you won. You won, but she knew.
In the words of James Ellroy, I know my shit.
Yeah, but they're all implicated, aren't they? And his buddy.
Racial memory. We're all guilty. We're all guilty.
Yeah, the place. I wanted to ask you, L.A., the place. You talked a bit about that, but I was just thinking that you're, reading your novels, reading The Black Dahlia, certainly, you use that phrase in it, which is the title of the novel that comes after The Black Dahlia, The Big Nowhere.
Yes.
Yeah, so Bucky's thinking, where is Lee? He's out there somewhere in the Big Nowhere.
Yeah.
Which is, that's L.A., isn't it? The Big Nowhere. It has a kind of imaginative geography, I think, in the novel, that you always, that truth of L.A. still, to get anywhere, you have to get in a car and go for an hour to somewhere. Mm-hmm. And everywhere in the novel, I kind of counted initially, and then I lost count. Everywhere in the novel is a kind of intersection. So you go to X and Y, which mm-hmm. is an intersection of two roads. And hardly ever do you walk down a street. So it is a kind of really strange sort of split-apart place in the novel. Are you conscious of that when you're writing it? Or is it just you live there and that's your natural...
I'm from L.A. I was hatched in the film noir epicenter at the height of the film noir era. Geography is destiny. I got lucky. My parents hatched me in a cool locale. I have no snappy epigrams on Los Angeles, the place. I do not view it as an outsider. I live there now. I've lived there at various times in my life. I was born and raised there. And to put all of this in perspective, when I was 12 years old, my dad, apropos of not much, my dad was from Boston, said to me, "Hey, kid, I fucked Rita Hayworth." Really, Dad, no shit. And that was the way we talked to each other. And I didn't believe him then, and 10 years after his death in 1975, I saw a Hayworth biography in a bookstore, looked his name up in the index, and indeed, he knew Rita Hayworth and was, in fact, her business manager and arranged her wedding to the Arab potentate, Ali Khan, in Paris in 1949 when I was one. That's about all you need to know about L.A. and I. What you need to know about crime fiction and Los Angeles is that two writers, varying levels of importance and greatness, Raymond Chandler, a less great writer, in many ways a more important writer, James M. Cain set their fictions there. Then the war occurred. After the war, what happened in cinema? Film noir. Yeah. Film noir is a style period that existed between 1945 and 1960. These were studio potboilers, most of them artless, that were filmed in and around Los Angeles because the studios were there and it was cheap to shoot on location in L.A. Hence, we associate film noir and by implication, the Los Angeles Police Department with it. Then I came around decades later. That's why L.A.
Are you consciously using the fact that all of us have a sort of cinema-filtered view of this period and this place?
No, I write for myself and for God. But I do know that in the collective unconscious, people think that way. Have I exploited it? Not consciously.
No. But it is part of the experience of reading. You know, when you go to the house of the rich people, you know, you think you've seen it before in a film, maybe, of a Chandler novel.
Yes.
And or in Chinatown or something. And some of the characters, the character types, you know, somebody says when Bucky's finally worked it all out and worked out what a sap he's been some of the time, he remembers Lee saying to him that thing, cherchez la femme, you know, and the characters in this, you know, the femme fatales who can't be resisted even though they also, Madeline in this novel,
right.
Even though
uh-huh.
she is, God, whoa, she's dangerous to know.
Yeah.
Those seem to be characters that we half know, we half recognise from, less from detective fiction maybe than from the films that are surrounding these people in this period.
If you're thinking of Phyllis Nerdlinger in Double Indemnity,
well,
who becomes
them, yeah.
Phyllis Dietrichson, yeah. in the motion picture, and Cora Smith, who remains Cora Smith. We're talking about The Postman Always Rings Twice, both the novella and the movie. Always keep in mind that the book came first.
Yeah.
Because why mince words?
Yeah.
The novel, the novella, the book is the greater art form. Let me ask you why. Why? It's the result of one man or woman's imagination.
So it's the...
It's indigenous to one individual. That's why.
Yeah. I mean, let's kind of turn to something, I mean, which you mentioned right at the beginning, which I think probably everybody here knows something about, which is not the fiction and the film, but the real story.
Yes.
The real story, because this is a novel which is based on a real case, and a case that you must have done a lot of research in order to kind of get the precision of the facts.
No, it's not. Yeah. It's not the case. The Black Dahlia was a young woman. She was an Irish Protestant girl from Medford, Massachusetts. It's a bedroom community outside Boston. She was a flaky, perhaps promiscuous, certainly irresponsible 22-year-old young woman who was horribly butchered. It was attenuated torture. She was bisected and dumped in a vacant lot in Los Angeles. It was January 15th, 1947. There were 5 daily newspapers. Radio was huge. The first local LA TV station, KTLA, would debut in April of that year. It's a hideous, vile, horrible story. It's the most celebrated unsolved murder in America and perhaps in world history. And it was a newspaper and radio sensation in Los Angeles in 1947, the year before my birth. On June 22nd, 1958, when I was 10 years old, the product of a broken home, my mother was a registered nurse. Her name was Jean Hilliker. She dumped my dad 3 years earlier. She was murdered on June 22nd, 1958. It was a rape murder. It remains unsolved to this day. I went to live with my dad. I was an early reader, an early voyeur, a fearful, sporadically violent, big, volatile child. On the occasion of my 10th birthday in March of 1959, my dad got me Jack Webb's book, The Badge. It was an ode to the Los Angeles Police Department. It contained a haunting 10-page summary of the Black Dahlia murder case. And in that moment, at age 11, inextricably, Jean Hilliker, who lived from 1915 to 1958, and Elizabeth Short, who lived from 1924 to 1947, became one in metamorphosis and transmogrification. I did not actively mourn my mother. She was strict. My father was permissive. I had early puberty stirrings pertaining to my mother that I was deeply ashamed of. And here was a stand-in siren, a good-looking young woman with no discernible relationship to my life as it actually was. Jean Hilliker, my mother, Elizabeth Short, just like this. I became obsessed with crime in that moment, LA's criminal and social history in that moment. I already only wanted to be a novelist and had no doubt with my early, impervious, ridiculous self-confidence that I would make that dream one day come true and would one day write Elizabeth's short story. When I wrote it, I had one moral and spiritual goal in mind: to consciously link Jean Hilliker and Elizabeth Short, to write a stirring, moving treatise on misogynistic violence, to honor Elizabeth Short, who did not get the chance to grow up and outgrow her ridiculous early ideals and early profligacy in the way that I did. And please believe me in this, I was much more profligate, much more heedless, and much more immoral than she ever was. And to honor Jean Hilliker by implication. That's that book. I did scant newspaper research, newspaper microfilm, and I cribbed together a story of two young men, a cop named Dwight Bleichert, a cop named Lee Blanchard, two boxers, and the woman, Kay Lake, that they love. Kay Lake, parenthetically, is the heroine of my new novel, Perfidia. It is a preceding story. It precedes The Black Dahlia by 6 full years. I think she's my greatest fictional creation, Kay Lake. Here she is in Perfidia at age 21. She will go on to marry Bucky Bleichert, who she's fixated on in Perfidia in 1949. She is the female fulcrum who is conscious in the manner that Elizabeth Short and my mother were rendered mute by vile, anonymous killers.
So, in a way, the first sentence of the book, or the first couple of sentences, which are narrated by Bucky: I never knew her in life. She exists to me through others, in evidence of the ways her death drove them. Working backwards, seeking only facts, I reconstructed her. So that's kind of you as well, is it? There's a kind of interweaving of what you are in, what you're doing and what he's doing when he's narrating.
Cherchez la femme. My historical books describe history as a state of yearning. It is the yearning for history itself, which exists deeply in me, in Perfidia, a novel that takes place the first month of America's entry in World War II. It is a yearning, a mass yearning, for allegiance, and it is a romantic and sexual yearning. It is my romantic's credo. Cherchez la femme.
Sticking with the narrator just a bit longer, there was a couple more things I wanted to ask you, and I was just thinking about his, what you were saying about the sort of origins of the novel. I mean, he, you give him quite a tangled and obsessive interest in the woman who's been murdered. And of course, he, you know, he can never know her, but he's pursuing the case. And he becomes really obsessed with her, doesn't he? And he sees her in the other women that he's having relationships with. And even, you know, in one case, something that we're used to only villains do in novels, but he's the sort of anti-hero, which is he makes a prostitute dress up.
Yeah.
And he kind of is on the brink of doing something bad to her, but he pulls back from
right,
it.
Right, right.
That seems like quite a risk to take with your narrator, who, however compromised, is the good guy. He is the good guy, isn't he?
He's the good guy, and think of Alfred Hitchcock's 1958, a prophetically designated year. Think of Hitchcock's great film, Vertigo. It was the last movie I saw with my dad. I saw it 2 weeks before my mother was murdered. What does Vertigo derive from more than anything else? I will tell you, it's Wagner's great opera, Tristan and Isolde. Bernard Herrmann's soundtrack is nothing but Tristan and Isolde. Tristan and Isolde, The Prelude, is the most influential piece of 20th century music, even though it was written in the 19th century. It's the unresolved harmonies. It's, as I write in Perfidia, the world as the strings drop. What happens in that movie? A man, a tall psychopath, people have compared me to him, tries to make a woman over in the image of a dead woman. Yours truly, junior pervert, voyeur, dope fiend, genius author, Elroy, sees that in early June of 58. His mother's murdered 2 weeks later. 27 years later, he writes The Black Dahlia. This, people, is racial memory. This is the crazy shit floating around in the Spiritus Mundi.
I said just now, when I was asking that question, I referred, perhaps rather awkwardly, to Bucky as the good guy. And I kind of wanted, before I threw out the, gave everybody here a chance to ask questions, I did want to ask you about something you said right at the beginning. You were talking about morality, and I was slightly taken aback by seeing a review. It was in a review of Perfidia in one of the newspapers, and it was an almost entirely complimentary review. And as if it were a compliment, the reviewer said, as is the case in all Elroy's work, there is no moral centre. And I think the reviewer was saying something like, you know, in the old days, detective novels, you knew what was right and what was wrong, more or less, and all that Chandler down these mean streets, a man must go, he's not himself mean. But no, James Ulroy, great, there's no moral compass at all.
Well, he's wrong.
He's wrong, isn't he?
Yes, he's wrong.
Good.
He's wrong. Here's the exposition of morality in literature. It's this. It's showing the consequences, the karmic upshot of immoral actions. You know who the good guys are, men and women in my books. Here's how they change. Here's how they find a sometimes full-hearted redemption, sometimes a tenuous redemption through love.
That's it. That's how you know.
Yeah.
Okay. God, that's quite... I mean, that's really old-fashioned, actually, isn't it? I meant it as a compliment.
Well, what's the last word, the last single word of the Black Dahlia? What's the last sentence? As Bucky Bleichert flies back to Boston to meet his pregnant wife, Kay Lake, a child will be born who will take the place of the devastated Elizabeth Short. Bucky Bleichert ruminates as he becomes fearful. Coming in, the airplane, the sky is dark. He's fearful. He's going back to an uncertain reunion with his pregnant wife. I asked Betty for safe passage in return for my love. It was the single finest moment of my life when I wrote that line. 2 seconds later, I wrote in my notebook the dedication, which was to Geneva Hilliker Elroy in 1958, mother 29 years later, this valediction in blood. You don't have many lines. You don't have many moments like that in your lifetime.
The festive season is fast approaching, so this year, while you're busy buying gifts for friends and family, why not treat yourself too? This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the simple yet powerful all-in-one website building platform. With Squarespace, you can easily create your own website for your small business, online store, professional portfolio, or blog. It's simple, and it'll be the one gift you know you won't want to return. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code GUARDIAN to get 10% off.
Are you ready for that?
Yeah, I was born.
Okay, we've got some microphones.
First of all, I'm a huge fan. Thanks for coming. You've written a lot of series of books which are based in the social and political development of America in the 50s and 60s, but you kind of stopped.
Yeah.
Are you going to carry on through to Nixon? And
No, I'm not.
You know,
my career as a historical novelist ends with J. Edgar Hoover's death. I'm going back with Perfidia, which is the first volume of the Second L.A. Quartet, and writing the Second L.A. Quartet for novels that will take characters from the Underworld USA trilogy, my big political novels, late 50s into 72, and the aforementioned L.A. Quartet, 1946 to 1958. The Black Dahlia, the Big Noir, L.A. Confidential, and White Jazz, putting them in L.A. during World War II as much younger people. Thus, there'll be an 11-year unified history of both my city and my nation. That's the grand design for the foreseeable future.
Can I just chuck in a question before we... So did, when you wrote The Black Dahlia, did you kind of have in mind that it was going to go on, that you were going to go on from it? Did you think of it being...
No, I only knew when I wrote The Black Dahlia that there would be four novels.
You did? Well, you did know that
yes,
it would be
I
one...
Did.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it was what, it was the first of four from the very moment you...
Halfway
sort of,
through,
okay.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, that's interesting. Yeah.
Hi, I've got a question about Perfidia. I won't do any spoilers in case anyone's not read it here. Kay Lake is a point-of-view character in the novel. She's the first female point-of-view that you wrote in the L.A. novels that you've written and the historical novels. Why did you choose her? Because you kind of have these archetypes of these violent white men, and then you go to Perfidia now, and it's this 21-year-old young woman who's got this ambition, and she's bored. Why did you choose Kay, and... how is she different to write compared to other characters?
There are two diary excerpt dominant voices in Bloods Are Over, my preceding novel, the book that was set between 1968 and 1972. There's a cop named Marshall Bowen, who's both black and a homosexual. That's one. And there's Karen Safekas, who's a left-wing Quaker. So there are precedents for this. Kay Lake is my favorite female fictional character in all of my books. She embodies the grit, the madcap nature, the style consciousness, and the sheer desire for transcendence that I believe characterized the World War II American woman. She is very much a romantic creation. So she is, of course, obsessed with symphonic romanticism and Beethoven, as I am. The German Elroy, they called Beethoven.
I just wondered what was the most plausible theory that you'd ever heard about who was actually responsible for the murder of...
We're never going to know, brother, who killed Elizabeth Short. At one point, I led with my heart and anointed ex-cop Steve Hodell's theory. It has been debunked a million times over since then. No theory, no fictional treatment can give language to the horror that Betty Short was subjected to in the last week of her life. A San Francisco newspaper man named Ed Bidex back in 1987 told me, kid, I like this book, but nobody can do justice or can pinpoint with any kind of moral or spiritual accuracy what happened to that poor, dear girl. You tried to honor her, and that is the only point to this.
Yes, please, sir.
Yeah, I'd just like some advice. I had an experience at the weekend where someone, a friend of mine, told me one of my books freaked them out so much that they ripped it up and set fire to it at the end of it. When you get blurred, or people make the mistake of blurring you with some of the deeds of your characters, and that space between the author and their imagination gets intertwined, how do you deal with that, and how do you...
I ignore it. I don't read reviews. There are particularly favorable reviews that people tell me about. And I'm computer illiterate. I've never used a computer. I've never owned a cell phone. I have never operated a computer. I have colleagues who keep abreast of this. By and large, I've learned to ignore bad reviews and misdeeds that are conflated with my own.
Hi, James. Thanks for being here. I'm a fellow Angeleno.
Hey, brother. And, where'd you go to high school?
Sure. High school.
Where's
Montebello?
That? Never been out there.
It's not as exciting as where you grew up. But anyway, and I'm a fellow historian. As you might imagine, when I tell other historians, I'm a fan of the Underworld trilogy. They grimace sometimes. Not that I mind. But I'm interested that you were talking about a lot about research today. And I'm curious, in the Underworld trilogy, you know, how much of that is research? How much is extrapolation? And what were some of your favorite sources for those novels?
The one question, well, there's more than a few, that I never answer is what's real and what's not in my books. I'm out to create a seamless verisimilitude. I'm out to give you, and this is my base métier, the secret human infrastructure of great public events. So I can't tell you what's real and what's not. I do threadbare research so that I may find the proper amount of latitude to create my own secret human infrastructure of great public events. That's how I do it. I know when to fictionalize and when to adhere to the truth.
Yeah, who did you enjoy killing most, Bobby or Jack?
Jack had to go. Bobby was my Ichiban. Robert F. Kennedy was the greatest crime fighter of the American 20th century. He went after organized crime, hammer and tong. He was the crime fighter that J. Edgar Hoover pretended to be.
Do you think that the noir has to be set in the 40s and 50s? Do you think it works in more contemporary novels?
There is no noir, sir. It's over. It existed between 1945 and 1960. Today, noir is a catchphrase. It's inaccurate. What people are really talking about is hard-boiled fiction. Hard-boiled fiction can be written by anybody, set any time in any galaxy. It's about language, whereas noir is about style and is primarily cinematic.
Do you ever have any self-doubt or writer's block?
I'm a confident public performer and a confident writer. I work hard, and God has gifted me with a sturdy will and desire to work hard. Now, that stated, let me quote the great Golda Meir. Don't be so humble, you're not that great. And it's in the Bible, without humility, there is no honor.
Which character gives you the most glee to write?
Kay Lake. Writing in a woman's diary format, Kay Lake waiting in the outer office of the left-wing, Fink to the Feds, psychiatrist to entrap his horn dog ass and gleefully describing her outfit with the scuffed saddle shoes, the Free the Scottsboro Boys button on the lapel of her collegiate blazer. Kay Lake, what a gas.
Yeah. Where have we got to? Please. Yes, and
James,
then there's
can you just tell us a little bit more about your writing process? You've touched on it a little bit, but when's a good time? Do you have a good time of day? I mean, what do you have around you? And what would be a single piece of advice you would give to an aspiring writer?
I get up early. I like to roll out of bed and get the drop on consciousness. I will often write from 3 in the morning.
until 6 in the morning, have a bowl of oatmeal, go back to bed for an hour and a half, go back at it again. I write by hand. The outline for Perfidio is 700 pages. That allows me to live in dramatic paradox. The overall structure of the book is mapped out in minute detail. I know every single place that it has to go. However, paradoxically, within that stricture, I am able to extrapolate at the level of individual scene. You have immediacy, you have the overall formal design. They are not at odds, they are synchronous. Does anybody want to ask me the big metaphysical question, why do you write?
Yeah.
Why do you write, Jay?
Why do I write?
Yeah.
In my craft or sullen art, exercised in the still night, when only the moon rages and the lovers lie abed in their arms, with all their griefs, round the ages, I pay no praise or wages, nor heed my art or craft. Dylan Thomas. God bless you. Thank you for coming.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.